I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, at least 75 dead and many remain missing after a catastrophic flash flood hit Kerr County and along the Upper Guadalupe River. This is one of the worst natural disasters to hit Central Texas, and Texans are coming together to offer support and aid. We're going to hear how to help communities of Kerr County recover from the floodwaters. And also, how did the National Weather Service perform leading up to the flood? After the Trump administration's layoffs, the Weather Service's defenders say it did its job. And later on The Source, we're going to hear from the Kerr County lead's Louis Amestoy to get the latest as rain threatens to continue falling in the region. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source. From Texas Public Radio, I'm David Martin Davies. Across Texas, at least 87 people are dead after heavy rains led to catastrophic flooding. Kerr County was hit the hardest with at least 75 deaths, including 27 children. Dozens remain missing. Search and recovery efforts are continuing along the Upper Guadalupe River. President Trump has signed a declaration of disaster for the county, and FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is on the ground. But this disaster isn't over yet. There continues to be flooding threats in the Hill Country. Parts of Central Texas are now under a 3 out of 4 threat for flash flooding. Kerr County, which is just outside the zone, is preparing for a new flash flooding, and that could change. More than 5 inches of rain is possible, and rainfall rates could climb to 3 inches per hour, overwhelming the already saturated soil. This rain is falling in an area known as Flash Flood Alley, which is prone to fast-moving and quick-rising creeks and rivers. Texans and folks across the nation are coming together to help Kerrville and the Kerr County area. We're joined by Austin Dixon, the CEO of the Community Foundation of the Hill Country. And Austin, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What y'all have been going through, what's been happening in the Hill Country, it boggles the mind. It defies the imagination. Many of us have been in the area, know the area, love the area, and it's just hard to come to grips with what has been happening over these last 3 to 4 days.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. It's iconic in the state of Texas and captures the imagination of many Texans and those of us in Central and South Texas love the Hill Country. It's a place where we've spent holiday weekends just like Independence Day, and it's a place that some of us grew up as campers, and some of us are lucky enough to call it home. And it's a special place that has turned into a really deadly scene that, you're right, it just boggles the mind.
So with what is the Community Foundation of the Texas Hill Country, and what are you doing to help with the recovery?
The Community Foundation is the charitable endowment for our region. We are very similar to the San Antonio Area Foundation that serves Bexar County and the surrounding counties. We're a 501c3 public charitable foundation that makes grants to nonprofit organizations and awards scholarships to students going to college and technical school in a 10-county region of the Hill Country. Our service area extends from Blanco and Fredericksburg over to Burney, Kerrville, Bandera, and all the way out to Uvalde and Lakey, Texas, if you're familiar with those areas. Our headquarters is in Kerrville in Kerr County, and we are a philanthropic institution that in normal times is granting money and making communities a better place. In times of emergency, we have created emergency funds to raise money from the public and then grant those funds out locally to meet needs that emerge in the short, medium, and long term. So in this crisis, the morning of July 4th, I woke up ready for a day with family. We had in-laws visiting. We had our barbecue plans laid out for a day of board games and cooking, and my phone was just vibrating with messages. And I knew very quickly that the Community Foundation had a role to play. And so we established the Kerr County Flood Relief Fund here at the foundation. And we've been accepting online donations and gifts from corporations, foundations, and regular old folks all across the world.
A lot of people want to help. They're itching to help. But, you know, there's so many scammers out there these days. We don't know, you know, the best way to help and to donate because of, you know, GoFraudMe accounts and things like that. So having something that we know is local, on the ground, that has a dedicated steward of these financial resources, that's significant. I mean, so that should give people some relief knowing that they could provide some support here.
Agree. And that's why we felt it was imperative to open up our Kerr County Flood Relief Fund so swiftly, is that in times of crisis, there's lots of voices that are competing for attention and dollars, and not all of those are valid, legitimate, or above board. And it's very confusing for people. And unfortunately, it capitalizes on human nature's tendency to want to just be of assistance and help and support and love in a time of crisis. So yes, the Community Foundation, we're a 501c3 public charity. We're over 40 years old. We are in the business of accepting donations and making grants locally in Kerrville, Kerr County, and throughout the Hill Country. It's the only thing that we do. It's our sole area of expertise. We have a board of trustees, of civic leaders, and a professional staff that's able to manage all of this stuff. I would say to the person that wants to help, right now, Kerr County is still very much in a search and rescue situation. We have 400 for.
Okay, I think.
Calming the riverbed. And right now, we have all the supplies, all the food, all the tools that we need. And the easiest way to get involved is to make an online donation.
Our signal, we're in San Antonio KSTX, but also in KTXI in Ingram in the Hill Country, and in Llano, we have a radio station there as well. So we're reaching those communities on the ground. How can anyone who thinks that they need some help from the Community Foundation, how do they reach out?
Right now, we are solely raising funds, and we are not making grants. We are still in the search and rescue part of this disaster. There are so many relief organizations here, both locally and nationally, that have food and water and are getting people reunited with families. There are ample places to go. The business community is rallying around. The Kerrville Area Chamber of Commerce is helping local businesses raise funds and get generators and get back on their feet. The president has said that we're a national disaster zone, which has freed up FEMA resources for individuals, families, and businesses to get cash assistance. And so I would direct people who have those immediate needs to those resources. Our grants are going to be going to vetted local nonprofit organizations in our area that are responding and doing the rebuilding and the recovery efforts for the short, medium, and long term. The Community Foundation is unable, and it is not lawful for us to be giving grants to individual people. And so we follow all IRS rules and regulations. And so we will only be granting to nonprofit organizations, first responder organizations, governments, and civic infrastructure institutions like electric companies and stuff like that.
We're almost out of time here, but quickly, how do you think this is going to take years to recover from?
We have over 20 miles of downed trees in the Guadalupe Riverbed, and I think it's going to take several years to clean up and get Kerrville back to normal, if we're ever back to normal again.
Austin Dixon, he is the CEO of the Community Foundation of the Texas Hill Country. You can find them online and give to their flood relief fund. Austin, thank you so much. When we come back from the break, we're going to be hearing about the National Weather Service answering some of the questions about how do they perform leading up to the July 4th flood. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. They are committed to helping policyholders build strong and thriving businesses through their exceptional service. More at texasmutual.com/texansdeliver. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
Public media is facing one of the most serious threats in its history. The House has voted to eliminate $1.1 billion in funding, putting trusted news, meaningful storytelling, and emergency alerts at risk. The Senate votes next, and you can contact your senators every day until they do. Tell them to reject these cuts and protect TPR. Visit tpr.org/resiliency to take action today.
This is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're covering the ongoing weather disaster along the Upper Guadalupe River caused by extreme heavy rains that fell over the weekend, causing a massive flash flood, killing dozens of people. There has been finger-pointing at the National Weather Service. Kerr County officials have said that they did not receive the warnings and emergency alerts. Beyond the blame game, we have got to get to the bottom of this because there will be more rain bombs and more flash floods and more catastrophic loss of life if we don't fix the extreme weather warning system. I spoke with Rick Spinrad. He is the former head of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Yeah, I think, well, there's a combination of factors going on here. First of all, obviously, my heart goes out to anyone that was impacted, and the loss of almost 100 people is devastating. It strikes me that a few things were going on. One is that the Weather Service did their job and did it according to standard practice and protocol in terms of getting out forecasts, getting watches and warnings out in sort of time frames that make sense, going back to Wednesday and then into Thursday. But of course, there have been a lot of cuts to personnel in the Weather Service. Weather Service is down probably about 25% on its staffing, including at the two weather forecast offices directly involved in the flooding on the Guadalupe River in San Angelo and Austin, San Antonio. Staffing shortages that resulted, for example, in perhaps not having the connectivity with the emergency management community, so that the real problems, I think, were what we call the last mile, getting the watches and warnings and alerts out is one thing. Making sure they are received and acted upon is something else. So when I look at the record, it looks to me like some 4 hours before the major flooding on the river, there was a what's called a WEA, a wireless emergency alert that went out. And this is done when there is, quote, considerable or catastrophic conditions, which obviously was the case. So the weather forecast was accurate. It was put out in a timely manner. The forecast predicted less rain total than was finally seen, but it was still at catastrophic levels. But the message wasn't received. So one has to wonder why the people affected did not get those WEA messages, were not able to respond accordingly. And of course, a lot of the detail is going to be sorted out in the assessments that are going to be done after things subside.
Well, here's a timeline of the forecast and alerts. Thursday, July 3rd, 1:18 p.m., the National Weather Service issued a flash flood watch for the Hill Country, forecasting up to 7 inches of rain overnight. Onto July 4th, as the thunderstorms developed, the National Weather Service upgraded it to a flash flood warning at 1:14 a.m., which triggered both National Alert System and the wireless emergency alerts on cell phones in Kerr and Bandera counties. By 4:26 a.m., the National Weather Service issued a rare flash flood emergency emphasizing an imminent life-threatening scenario with 6 to 10 inches of rain, with an additional 3 to 4 inches of rain expected. That happened.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, you can issue the alerts, but if it doesn't get to the people who are in the harm's way, that's the problem.
That's the problem. That's also the last mile. So the question is, why were the people who were impacted by the floods not aware? Certainly with the flash flood, the first flash flood warning, which I believe was actually at 11:40, and then at 1:14 a.m. On the 4th, the WEA that described the considerable and catastrophic impact was sent out. That 1:14 WEA is something that should have been picked up by everybody that was in harm's way. So the question is, why was that not received? And why did people not take the action to evacuate when they had at least a few hours to take action?
Officials in Kerr County have said, well, they predicted 7 inches of rain and we got 12 inches of rain. They consider that the problem. Is that a distinction without a difference as far as you're concerned?
I don't think there's a lot of difference between 7 inches of rain and 12 inches of rain in the sense that both are catastrophic. Obviously, you're going to get more flooding with 12 inches of rain. But by the time the Weather Service was putting out the forecast that had these huge, huge volumes of rain, 7 inches of rain in that amount of time is quite significant. That alone merited the flash flood warning, and people should have been advised to take action accordingly. The fact that it went up to 12 inches, I think, is a reflection of the need to probably improve our understanding of extreme precipitation. There's a lot of research that's being done. NOAA's laboratory in Norman, Oklahoma has been premier for doing that. That, I would point out, is a laboratory that is slated to be shut down by the administration. And this actually gets to Secretary Noem's comment. I do not know what she's talking about with respect to antiquated equipment. NOAA and the National Weather Service have very aggressive recapitalization programs for things like the weather radars around the country. NOAA is always updating and improving its use of computer models, looking to the applications of artificial intelligence. And so consequently, the major change that has been made by this administration of the Weather Service is the reduction in staffing and the firing of staff in the Weather Service. And I think we're starting to see the consequences of that in terms of the horrible developments in Texas this weekend.
This particular weather event, where we had the remnants left over from Hurricane Barry sitting on top of central Texas, moisture coming in from the Gulf. We didn't have a front moving through there. You can see the weather coming 100 miles away, 200, 500 miles away, and you can predict it showing up. This seems to be a very difficult thing for many of the weather models to predict. Is that true?
Yeah, there were some complications, and I think it was a combination of different systems coming in together to create an extreme precipitation event, which is exactly why NOAA has worked so aggressively to try to develop new models, new capabilities for making observations to predict these kinds of events better, and has made a lot of progress and success. Let's not lose sight of the fact that the initial watches and warnings came out more than a day in advance, and largely as a result of the improvements in these models and the improvements in the ability to collect data in the atmosphere using satellites, using radars, and many other sensors.
To the point about the understaffing that we have with the National Weather Service at those two offices in Texas, and you said they were in San Angelo and in Austin, San Antonio?
That's correct, yes.
And so how much of an impact does the reduction, you said about 25% of staff in these offices, how does that relate to having weakening the ability to provide these warnings?
So the offices are staffed with particular functions specifically to ensure that you've got enough people focused on the science of measuring the environmental conditions and building a forecast, and somebody who's working closely with coordinating the warnings with the emergency management community, somebody making sure that there's enough IT connectivity, that messages are getting in and out the staffing is, as with any office, established with specific needs being attended to by specific personnel. When you reduce the number of personnel, you end up either doubling up on responsibilities or actually marginalizing some of those responsibilities. And it stands to reason that when you reduce the staffing, some of these functions are going to end up being compromised. And perhaps, it's not confirmed at this point, won't be until a full assessment is done, but perhaps some of the ability to actually coordinate with the emergency management community and make sure that not only messages are being sent, but that they are being received, understood, and acted upon is where the personnel shortages really impacted operations.
So do you think that these layoffs have resulted in exposing the public to dangers of hazardous weather?
There is no question in my mind that reducing the staffing in the National Weather Service increases the risk of exposing the public to more danger and puts public and property and lives at more risk as a result.
The Trump administration has performed these layoffs. It is in Project 2025, which is the Heritage Foundation's playbook for the Trump administration, which they have used to do a lot of their policies. It is indicated in Project 2025 that they want to privatize weather forecasting in the United States. Do you think that this is a result of that?
There already is a very effective public-private relationship in terms of weather and weather forecasting. Very successful companies like AccuWeather and the Weather Channel work hand in glove with the National Weather Service. And it's taken many years to figure out how that relationship works. It's effective, it's efficient. It ensures that the public gets what they're already paying for with their tax dollars through the Weather Service. So every single American can get a quality forecast. If they want what's called added value, tailored forecasts, that's something they can pay for. That model works and works well. The assumption that we could eliminate the public National Weather Service and have all of that functionality picked up by the private sector, one, is not substantiated by any analysis, and two, doesn't seem to be something that the private sector is eager to take on for a whole variety of reasons. So cutting staff in the public sector on the assumption that the private sector will pick up the load is ill-advised, not justifiable, and will result undoubtedly in increased loss of life and property damage.
What do you think went wrong? Why were so many people unaware, caught off guard, including public officials in Kerr County, that they were vulnerable, that there was this terrible weather system coming in, that they were going to be exposed to a flash flood?
I really can't answer that without better knowledge of how messages were not received and acted upon. And so it could be that communications lines were not in effect. It could be that opportunities for training people on how to respond to these warnings and watches that came out was not sufficient. But I'm not well enough advised right now with respect to all the details to be able to say this is the cause of failures.
What do you think needs to be changed to keep this from happening again?
Well, that's a great question, because we know this is not the last natural hazard that we're going to face in this country. We're certainly in the middle of hurricane season. There's tornadoes developing throughout the Midwest. We're going to see heat waves in the Southwest, wildfires in the Northwest. I think we need to take a close look at how emergency management, including the Federal Emergency Management Agency and NOAA and other state and local agencies, are collectively sharing information, acting on advisories, watches, and warnings, and assess where the weak links are in the chain to go from extraordinary forecasts to warnings to evacuations or other activities by those that are going to be impacted. We need to assess where the weak links are in that chain.
What role does climate change, global warming have in setting up that we have more of these types of rain bombs that happened in places like Central Texas?
So climate change very clearly means that we're seeing more energy put into the system, which means the atmosphere can hold more moisture. It means that we're going to see more severe storms, strong hurricanes, larger hurricanes, extreme precipitation events. And by any measure, we've seen that happening. I think we can expect that we're in a new normal in the sense that more of these kinds of flash flooding events, as well as extreme droughts and major tornado outbreaks, perhaps, are going to become more evident and more part of the portfolio that NOAA has to deal with.
Rick Spinrad is the former head of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. When we come back from the break, we talk with Louis Amestoy of the Kerrville Lead to get the latest, and we also open up the phones, 833-877-8255. This is The Source from Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The disastrous situation in Kerr County continues to develop. We're now joined by Louis Amestoy. He is a journalist with the Kerr County Lead, a digital news outlet there. He joins us to discuss the deadly 4th of July weekend flood. And Louis, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me.
Our phone lines are open. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Louis, you've been going wall-to-wall since this disaster began to develop, since the early morning hours of July 4th. How are you holding up?
Well, we're managing. You know, it's I'm considerably older now than I was when I was covering big fires in Southern California. You could stay up for 24 hours, so that's been a challenge to go to about midnight or 1 a.m. and then I'm like, I gotta sleep for a bit. But yeah, we're doing okay. It's been a lot. Today's going to be a very difficult day. The death toll continues to rise. The Camp Mystic sent out a press release or a note on its website saying all 27 girls and the counselors were gone. And then, you know, you have the official press conference. They're still kind of, I think, holding out hope that they'll find these 10 remaining girls. But, you know, I think we're all pretty much prepared for that reality. That's not going to happen. And I think for a lot of us here, you know, and I said this before, that, you know, I'm a dad. My kids are older now, but I got grandsons, and I can't imagine anything worse than that. And I can't imagine the grandfather being the guy in Miami who confirmed that his granddaughters were dead. I can't imagine that. And I'm so, you know, crushed by this. And I think that's led us to down some weird spaces here. And I was listening to your interview earlier with the former NOAA guy. And, you know, I got some thoughts on the National Weather Service. He may not want to hear, but.
We'll get to that.
Yeah. But I think it's a difficult situation for us here. And, you know, we'll, the recovery will be long. And I really, you know, Austin Dixon said it well too, earlier too, and Austin's great. And the Community Foundation will do amazing work in making sure that this community is taken care of. This community gave for Uvalde heavily. And he helped organize, you know, the Uvalde relief that the Community Foundation ran. So, you know, Kerr County is a remarkable place to call home. You know, it's the natural beauty, but I know so many great people here. And that's why doing what I'm doing. I don't think I could have done what I'm doing here in any other place in the country than right here in Kerrville, Texas.
Let's go to a caller just to open up the conversation, see what people have to say. Let's go to Randall on the phones. And Randall, you're on the air.
Hi, this is not going to be quick. I'll warn you right up. Louis talked about going wall to wall and all of that. And thank you for all of that. And thank you to you, David, and the rest of the staff there at Texas Public Radio and the Texas newsroom in general for putting in the long hours throughout the holiday weekend. This is why we need public broadcasting. Okay, that's out of the way. Camp Mystic is getting a lot of attention, understandably, but you know, there are several summer camps all along the Guadalupe River. During my youth in the 1970s, some years I got sent to two of them, the Herman Sons Camp in Comfort and the Texas Catholic Boys Camp, also known as Camp Tecaboca, near Mountain Home, Texas. And Tecaboca is right on the Guadalupe River. All of the swimming and canoeing at Tecaboca was done in the Guadalupe River. My last year at Tecaboca, to earn our Red Cross Advanced Swimmer patch, we had to do a one-mile swim in that river. We followed a counselor in a canoe going half mile upstream and then back downstream to the docks. And ironically, Tecaboca permanently shut down just like 3 or 4 months ago. So,
Rendell, what's your point there, buddy?
But I feel that you know, Camp Mystic had this unplugged policy, and that served them well for 99 years, and all of the camps were like that. But I fear that kind of thing is going to have to be reevaluated a little bit, and I worry that some of these camps, if the floodwaters don't do them in, the rising liability insurance rates may wipe some of them out. I hope not.
Okay. All right. Well, Rendell, thank you for the call and those observations and memories of the area. Lewis, what do you think? What does the future look like for these camps?
Well, I don't know. I hope, you know, the camps were already sort of under stressors in a lot of ways, from the way that Texas now, you know, does school, and there's a much shorter season for camping, basically just the month of July. So you've in the end of June and into July, and used to be, you know, June, July, and August were sort of reliable for the camps, and that's not necessarily the case anymore. And so they were already seeing those pressures. They couldn't find staff. They can't find, you know, campers, or, you know, and it's still a big deal.
They're valuable real estate.
And it's valuable real estate too. And, you know, it's amazing real estate. Mystic is gorgeous. The caller was correct in a way. I think a lot of these places, like, you know, you come here, we take away the technology from you. You know, we're here to be, you know, have interpersonal connections. I was, interestingly, on the Monday before the 4th of July, I did a live webcast from Mo Ranch, which is on the North Fork of the Guadalupe River, and one of our more, you know, one of our bigger camps. They were able to evacuate everybody to higher ground quickly. They finally gave up on the Wi-Fi issue. You know, they're like, come here and not, you know, be on your phones. And they had to basically upgrade to fiber to get everybody connected. And there's also a significant cell phone tower in that as well. So you have 5G coverage out that far out into the hill country.
So they're giving up on that fight. I'm going to go to another caller. Let's go to Debbie. And Debbie, thanks for calling in. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. My family has lived in the New Braunfels area, Lake McQueenie area. I myself live on Medina Lake. And we have, especially in the New Braunfels area and that particular part, there are always sirens. And so when we hear those sirens going off, people know immediately that you need to get to higher grounds. And I'm curious why that part of the Guadalupe doesn't have a siren system.
Great question.
Especially with all the RV parks and the camps up there.
Debbie, great question. Let's see so what do you think, Lewis?
I've heard this before, that they tried to do this several years ago and the cost was rejected by, you know, the community. I can't speak to that necessarily. It's not something that I've reported on or that's been an issue. There was some work on a flood warning system going into effect that UGRA, the Upper Guadalupe River Authority, was going to work on with the county as well. And I don't know, there was sort of a hill country, you know, group there. And I'd have to go back and specifically find that in a commissioner's court agenda, but there has been some preliminary work on that effort. But you know, again, I don't know, you know, I don't even know if we have tornado sirens here, and we've been prone to, I've been here for 6 years and we've had, you know, like a really bad straight line wind thing that happened, which is basically was a small sort of tornado. We had, you know, the winter storm, you know, hit us both in 21 and 22. So we've had significant, and then we've had drought, you know, and one of the things that we've seen here is that we get these alerts all the time about this, you know, about, you know, floods. And, you know, we, you know, I think there's some good things in place with the wireless caller, with the wireless cell phones. So that to me is still the more powerful of the delivery systems out there. But if you don't have Wi-Fi, of course, then that's an issue. So maybe in the upper parts of the river, yeah, that'd be something.
If you're out of cell service.
Yeah.
And so do you think that the community will come together and reassess and rethink? I don't know what kind of solutions works for them, but you think they were going to at least puzzle this out again?
I think so. But, you know, I mean, I don't know. You know, the Monday morning quarterbacking on the, you know, which I'm good at, but the Monday morning quarterbacking on the response and things like that, I don't even know if that the sirens would have helped from what I've heard. You know, I mean, I've heard people say, hey, I was coming out of my house 3 minutes later, you know, there's water to my knees, you know? So you're talking about, and then up at Mystic and River Inn, some of the videos I've seen from River Inn, I mean, they're stunning. And so I don't know. I think there's a question though coming up, you know, where what do we do about building in these areas in the future? Does Camp Mystic and these other camps and these other RV parks that are basically right on top of the river get to continue to exist in this area? And that's going to be probably a bigger question. And that's something that the state and the legislature and the federal government is going to have to address.
We're going to take a break here to 1 minute break. I'm going to get Jose and Patty on the air in just a moment. If you got a question, you can give us a call, 833-877-8255. We'll continue our conversation about the flash flooding in the Hill Country. There is still a threat of flash flooding happening in the area right now. And so if this is Flash Flood Alley, the area is prone to fast-moving, quick-rising creeks and rivers. If you come across fast-moving water, do not try to cross it. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. If you're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a conversation with Louis Amestoy. He is the publisher and the editor of the Kerr County Lead, which is a digital news outlet, which provides news and information to the folks in Kerr County. And the lead story is they're dealing with the flood that has killed at least 75 people. There is a search and recovery effort continuing, and they are transitioning to a recovery effort. It's going to take a long time. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255. So, Louis, I told you I'd let you go off on the National Weather Service. Can you just take a couple of minutes so we can get to the callers about what is your take on the National Weather Service?
Well, I trust the National Weather Service, you know, implicitly, quite frankly. And I use them every day. I'm on their site every day, you know, trying to, you know, write a weather forecast for my email newsletter in the morning that I leverage from their work. I don't really trust anybody else other than them. And most meteorologists would probably say that that's their trusted source as well. In this situation, I went to bed at 11 o'clock at night on the 3rd, and we had a big concert planned here for Friday. And it was Robert Earl Keen and William Beckman. And everyone was fired up for this concert, right? We probably were going to have 7,000 or 8,000 people here for this. And, you know, the forecast then was sort of like, hey, there's a chance of rain. I've got the messages at some point saved, but there's going to be a chance of rain. There's, you know, there's a flood watch in effect. But I wouldn't say it was urgent, right? Now, if they issued urgent warnings via their website, which quite frankly, you know, you have to know how to kind of navigate a little bit, then that's one thing. And but I did not see an actual text message alert, like you get on like an Amber alert or a phone alert, until after 7 o'clock in the morning. And I was coming down Coley Drive, which basically drops you right into Louise Hayes Park, which is where the river was just ripping. And all I could see as I was coming down this little hill here into the towards the park was the river at basically eye level. The whole horizon was the river. It was all the way up, you know, to Thompson Drive, which is, you know, from the good part of the river, it's a couple hundred yards, right, from the where the river normally is into to Thompson Drive. And it was right below the bridge there on 27 or on 16 and Highway 16. And then it was going. So as I'm driving down the street, then the phone goes crazy, right? That's the first time I heard an alert. And then I heard alerts the rest of the day. So I don't know what happened there, you know? Does somebody have to push the button? That's the question I've got.
Well, maybe there was no person there because of the layoffs.
Well, and that's you know, I was the one that asked that question of Christy Noem. And she was, you know, when I was at the shouting match press conference, you know, I got a loud voice and I'm old and grouchy. And so I threw that at her, you know, and she's like, oh, we got antiquated system, you know, reports. And
yeah,
you
know, so that's not true. Let's go to Jose on the phones. Yeah. And Jose, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Thank you. Condolences. My neighborhood there, it's been a very somber weekend, especially with this news. But what I wanted to ask, wanted to ponder was, in these natural areas, I frequent one in Bandera, and they posted a warning on their website on July 4th. And the warning was that warning of inclement weather and be prepared to move to high ground. Now, that's the website, but aside from you would not be able to access that information from the natural area because there's no technology there. There's no internet, and there's no cell communication or very little cell communication. So my question is, rather than conflate the NOAA issue with what's happening now, there may be two different problems. One is the access to the ability to use your technology to get that information, to get those warnings. The good thing I see now is that there was a warning, the 1:15 a.m. warning that went out that could have saved lives had everybody had access to that information. That's what I'm gathering now. What technologies are available to these locations, especially dire, to receive this dire information?
All right, Jose, thank you for the call. There is those, you know, NOAA radios, alert radios, you know, but that's not something that's very common, I would imagine. Lewis?
No, I would agree. I mean, unless you're going to put up sirens in there, and you know, there was apparently there was a question of expense and something I'm looking at, you know, down the road here. Like I said, you know, I have complete confidence in the forecasting of the National Weather Service, and if you listen to some of the forecasters and the real experts, you know, there were elements of this storm that you could not predict.
Right, there's not a squall that's moving across the map.
No, it just pops up and then it goes crazy and it comes in really fast. And, you know, and so you can't really track it. And now they've got the radar data to kind of show that. And if you look at the USGS's, I got 2 points on this. If you look at the USGS data, it shows you how fast the river was running. It was incredible, right? In like 25 and 30 minute increments.
It was blowing out the gauges.
Yeah, it blew out the gauge in Hunt. And so, you know, so the other point here is that, look, yes, there was definitely, they did their jobs, but how that job got communicated, that needs to be looked at. And if there was somebody who couldn't press a button to get it to everyone's phones, I mean, here's the thing, right? Yeah, Camp Mystic may have been on lockdown as far as, you know, as far as like technology, but there would have been an adult there who got that message probably and got them woken up and got them out of there. And so, you know, for me, like personally, I was dead asleep during this thing. Dead asleep.
Let's go to Patty on the phones. And Patty, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. When I had called in, it was regarding the sirens, and then Debbie mentioned that, because I grew up in Wisconsin. We had sirens for tornadoes. When you heard that, you were down in the basement in the west corner, and you stayed there until they went off. And it just seems odd, especially with the weather changing and climate change. There's got to be sirens. There's got to be something to warn people. I mean, I can't imagine myself, if I had a child or grandchild, I'd want them to go to camp, not knowing that there's any way to protect them if something like that happens. It just seems insane that someone's not watching this river when you're getting these warnings. Okay, so the weather's not telling you that, but why aren't city managers or somebody watching that when you know it's a big weekend, you have all these people out there camping along this river, and you're not monitoring it yourself?
All right,
you can't always just depend on the weather.
Patty, thank you for that. So, Lewis, I did an interview with a researcher from the University of Texas at Austin. She studies how aware people are, Texans are, in the Hill Country of their flash flood vulnerabilities. And mm-hmm. she finds that people generally are not aware that they live in something called Flash Flood Alley and that this could happen to them. How does that ring to you?
I think for anybody who's lived here for any period of time, which there's a lot of people who've lived here and they remember the 1987 floods. We just had a big flood here last year, you know, then Johnson Creek, and it flooded parts of Louise Hayes Park, you know, and we were all kind of, everyone kind of, you know, went to the river to see this storm, and it did some damage in Ingram. I think people here, a lot of people have moved here in recent years. They may not have the healthy respect for the river. You know, I worked for a number of years in Bakersfield, California, where the Kern River actively tries to kill you at any chance it gets. So I've always had a really, really big respect for this. But this river, in most cases, you know, it's beloved, man.
When it was 2 feet July 2nd, you know, and so it was barely a river.
It's barely a river right now through Kerrville, you know. And so I think we might have been lulled into, this is the new norm, you know, this is the new norm, you know, of, you know, now, you know, up here in this area, which is very conservative, you know, the climate change discussion is a non-starter, you know, for most of them. You know, you brought that to the commissioner's court here, their meeting today, that's a non-starter for them. So that's the other challenge too, is that you can say, well, we got all this rain coming, and they're not gonna buy that argument, I should say.
All right, let's go to the last caller, James. And James, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. Just wanted to start by saying my thoughts and prayers go out to everybody affected. It's just a tragedy. I live on the Guadalupe River. We live right at 281 in the Guadalupe and Spring Branch. And my comment was going to be, if we're going to prevent this in the future, sirens are great. All of that is good if you can implement it. But I think one of the most effective things is we need to get everybody out of the floodplain. When we built our house, we had to be outside of the 100-year floodplain. We're 50 feet elevation above the river. When the river came up at our house, it came up 30 feet, but we were still safe. And so I was going to just say, is it possible to get that enforced? And what would it take for everybody to move outside of that floodplain?
All right, James, thank you for that. I don't know if the state of Texas wants to flex that kind of muscle, Lewis.
Yeah, that's my question for them. You know, there's, you know, I believe FEMA approved, you know, the, you know, Mystic's, you know, expansions through the years, and it was in the floodplain. I'm like, all right, it's fine. I think that there is, you know, Texans believe in property rights, very absolutely. And they don't want to be told what to do with their property. And they don't want to, they're like, well, I'll run the risk of, you know, whatever it's going to be.
Right.
The reality of it is that at some point they're going to have to say, look, this isn't just about you. This is about our entire community. And the collateral damage of a flood is so significant that you cannot be in this floodplain. And I don't know.
There's a lot of discussions, a lot of debates that will be happening about this. But right now, the recovery and the grieving is underway.
Yeah. I don't know that anybody has the political will to have that conversation in Texas at this point.
Yeah. Well, these are tough times. Lewis Amestoy, he is a journalist. He is the publisher, the editor,
the
number one bottle cleaner at the Kerr County Lead. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Good job, man. Thanks.
This is Source from Texas Public Radio.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.